Hey, what is going on, Los Angeles? It's J-Dot, T-Dot, and I hope that you are very well. It is Friday, April 12th, 2024, and on this installment of JT the LA Storyteller podcast, yours truly chats it up with P, the horrible vandal, on all things Los Angeles, but especially on graffiti in Los Angeles. It's a really heartfelt episode, and I got a good feeling you're going to enjoy it. But before we get into the episode, I just want to make a slight correction about something I said during our last podcast session about the largest marches ever, that is, in the United States, at least. I said at one point that the marches for immigrant rights in the United States were, in fact, the largest in U.S. history, but they are in the top 10. And in fact, maybe even the top five, though they are not actually the largest ever in U.S. history. So why not take this opportunity to go through a brief list of the largest marches ever and when they took place right here in the U.S. You may not be surprised to hear that 4 out of 5 of these marches were actually just over the 2000s era. So at number 5, we have the 2018 Women's March. And during this march, about 1.5 million people nationwide came out. I remember those marches right here in Los Angeles. They were, in fact, pretty major and pretty impressive, so got to give them their respect. The 4th largest marches were the March for Our Lives marches, or these marches against gun violence. These also took place in 2018, and they were nationwide. For that march, or for those marches, about 1.2 to 2 million people came out in support of gun control and calling for gun control. The 3rd largest march was, in fact, the 2017 Women's March. That saw 3.3 to 5.6 million people come out nationwide, and I was definitely there. There was definitely a lot of energy in the air. There was a whole lot of pink all over the place, and there was a lot of nastiness in the face of those who would have us be less nasty. So much respect to the 2017 Women's March. The 2nd largest march actually took place on Earth Day, which is coming up on Monday, April 22nd, this 2024. But the 2nd largest march in the United States ever took place on Earth Day 1970. This was a march for the environment and for environmental protection, and it is estimated that about 20 million people came out nationwide for that march. So definitely fascinating to jot that one down. I had not heard of such a large march before, so now I'm going to kind of look into that for Earth Day. And in first place, that is topping the list for the largest marches in U.S. history ever, is in fact the March for George Floyd and the March Against Police Violence with respect to George Floyd's murder at the hands of police officer Derek Chauvin back in 2020. So these marches took place nationwide, and they saw between 15 to 26 million people come out nationwide. So these were definitely much larger marches than the March for the Great American Boycott or the March for A Day Without an Immigrant, but it does still stand that in Los Angeles, the Day Without an Immigrant March of 2006 remains the largest march in LA history. So these marches nationwide were not the largest ever in U.S. history, but certainly in Los Angeles, they remain the largest that the streets out here have ever seen. So just wanted to make that quick correction for the record and for your reference. And with that said, here is yours truly, along with P, the horrible vandal, on all things L.A., especially graffiti in L.A. It's J-Dot, T-Dot. It's Jimbo times. What's good? What's good? It's another installment of JT, the LA Storyteller Podcast. I'm here at the Robinson Space. Shout out to the Robinson for providing this podcast studio session to you and I and all the people of Los Cuentos de Los Angeles. I'm here with P, the Horrible Vandal, not originally from LA, but now well embedded into the LA culture. And of course, I want to give you a chance to know whatever else about yourself that you'd like to get out there, just for the record.
Yeah, I got into graffiti through hip-hop culture. I started like breakdancing, the b-boy culture. Originally from Virginia, not a place to live, had to get out. ended up in San Diego 2016, the beginning of 2016. And yeah, I've been out here in Cali, based in Cali. Definitely grew here a lot. I came to California with $600 in a backpack with some punk rock kids, and I got dropped off in San Diego. They kept going to Mexico, and yeah, it's we've talked a little about David Cho, and a lot of LA artists have always been influential to me, but it's crazy, like, living here now and just, it's the way I've networked and how it organically just kind of came to be, and me meeting artists from South Central LA, downtown LA, and Koreatown. Shout out all the Koreatown kids and everybody in South Central. Like, there's always been a lot of love in LA, and that's how I ended up here from San Diego. Just 4 years living in San Diego County, and then at a certain point, it was just like, I'm here every weekend, and it's like, dude, you should just move here. Yeah. And it's like, you know what? Like, that was actually like one of the dreams from the get-go, because Koreatown is such a mecca for maybe for me, because some of my favorite artists are from here, but also the Korean culture to me. I happen to be Korean. It's pretty dope to like come to a place where it has the most Koreans outside of Korea. And me growing up out east, I didn't grow up in a part of town where there was a lot of Koreans. So yeah,
that was a homecoming,
right? For sure. Mm-hmm. for sure it was dope. No, I love Koreatown and all, like, the everything in between, the nooks and crannies, just everything. You'll see me around town.
That's right.
If you know
that's right, through and through, from one part of the city to the next. We were walking a little bit through Virgil Avenue, and we got to talk a little bit about the way that Virgil Avenue has seen so much transformation, as the city of LA has, as South Central or historic South Central has, and as K-Town is currently seeing just as well. So I mentioned to you that looking at these communities, thinking about them, and seeing what is at risk in the days ahead for these places that we care so much about, that's huge for me, and all the more so as Los Angeles continues developing in the private interest and in the interest of private profiteers out there. So I'm definitely curious about the graffiti tower as another example of, as we were saying earlier before the podcast, private property clashing with the public interest, especially when this private property has been abandoned, is basically dilapidated or falling apart, is really kind of serving no purpose, and is really kind of there just taking up a lot of space. It's interesting, right, to me that when a graffiti writer or a handful of graffiti writers decide to take up space there just as well through this form of expression, that it then becomes a problem, that it then becomes an item, and that it then becomes actually a huge investment for the city, especially in terms of its policing apparatus. I mean, it is dystopian, as you described this scene to me, where you've got kids getting chased around at the same time that these TikTokers are out and about, basically posting about it because it's a huge spectacle for them. But there's actually so much on the line there, really.
LA in a nutshell. And to catch anybody up on what Oceanside Plaza or the graffiti towers are in LA, I think Business Insider says a broke Chinese real estate developer had left Los Angeles with an empty graffiti-covered tower that cost billions to finish. And they built this large tower plaza in Los Angeles, but ran out of funds in 2019. And now mainly it's used by graffiti artists, and I guess the police are being paid to patrol and protect that building 24 hours.
Right. Police have been taken off of other areas and sent over to the graffiti literally towers. Yeah. And it's just, it's fascinating because growing up in Los Angeles, there is so much graffiti that our communities come across on a day-to-day basis. And so speaking with you and catching up a little bit about what the scene in LA has looked like most recently is so key for me, because I want to know where the graph writers are and what their basic goal is through the city in 2024. I mean, with so much gentrification taking over LA, with so much gentrification pushing a lot of our communities out of the places they've historically called home, with so many people locked up in the California prison system or just the prison industrial complex altogether, where is graffiti in Los Angeles? I mean, is it more criminalized than it has been historically, or is it in a weird space because the police have made priorities elsewhere, especially given all the homelessness in Los Angeles? I mean, you got to kind of get me up to speed to some extent here.
Yeah, it's kind of a joke. I mean, a lot of cops they're not taking you in. It's like, I feel like even amongst police officers, it's like there's crime in the streets. There's a lot of fentanyl. There's a lot of drugs that are killing the streets right now. And like, you can see it visibly in LA. And it's like, to bring in a guy who's tagging their name, like, really, you want to be that guy? I don't think so. I feel like even despite that, the fact that they can, of course, it's at an officer's discretion, but they're definitely not, from what I've seen, taking anybody in actively. But, you know, there's always exceptions. You know, you never know who's out there in their situation. But it seems like LA has been very lax, because when I first moved here, there were potentials. And, you know, me being a little newer to the scene, 2017 was like the first time I've ever painted in LA, visiting from San Diego County. And you could catch a felony if you weren't, you know, careful. And just depending on how you would, you know, get panned out on that, and, you know, what part of town you were in. But you see downtown now, and it's like, when I first moved here, Second Street Tunnel, for example,
right,
that was something that I was never tagged up or marked. You wouldn't even, and if you did see something like that, it was gone the next 2 days. You see Second Street Tunnel now, that was the graffiti towers before the graffiti towers. That right. was, yeah, and definitely.
Right. And it's kind of interesting because I think a little bit about all the four lease signs going up and the four lease signs that have gone up. But all of this space that was formerly privately held or something to this effect, that's now just going to sit there at the same time that the city has less police, actually, and at the same time that the city has less personnel for, say, sanitation or street cleaning and so on and so forth. And so there's a lot more on the way in terms of that public versus private clash, in my view, but all the more so because the Olympics are just around the corner. And as you were saying, in 2019 or in 2020, especially with the amount of fentanyl on the street and the amount of people or tents that have been erected on LA sidewalks, police have just had to deal with that in one respect or another, while graffiti has kind of fallen as a priority, I imagine. Though, with something like Graffiti Tower, where the LA City Council has approved millions of dollars to patrol the space, clearly there's kind of a reassessment there, and there has to be, because given all of the new four lease signs that are going to be going up through 2024 and 2025 and 2026 and so on, there's going to be a lot more graffiti, a lot more writers getting out there. And I wonder if LA, which has definitely sent taggers or writers to jail or prison for decades on end,
and it's like you said,
getting back to that.
Right. No, and it's like you said with the gray area. You were saying something like earlier about like how people were incarcerated for graffiti and things like that. Now it seems like, have you ever heard of the broken window theory?
Definitely.
So the whole concept of like, oh, there's a broken window here, there's more likely to be graffiti here. And if there's more likely to be graffiti here, there's more likely to be a crime committed here. You look at it now and it's like, I don't even know if that's existing anymore, because you see graffiti in Virgil Avenue and it's like, oh, it's a hip neighborhood.
Right.
It's like, you might actually increase value in your neighborhood by adding a couple of murals or like some artists. And it's kind of crazy. So let graffiti be a export for LA. I mean, some of the best graffiti mural artists, street artists are coming out of LA. Let them get a part of that when the Olympics comes to LA. It's all about cultural exchange, isn't it? Like, LA is such a good hub. Like, I know we're excited about the Olympics coming. Of course, there's also a dark side to like major cities doing infrastructure development and things like that when the Olympics comes into their town.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, especially as you mentioned that, I think a lot about how LA's embrace of immigrant culture and even street art or street thoroughfares or working class culture in general, I think a lot about how that has shifted over the past couple of decades and the way that street vendors actually have a lawsuit against the city of LA right now, which they are very likely to win, in effect, providing the right for street vendors to be out on LA sidewalks, conducting their business and so on. But I think about, as we define LA, while we invite the rest of the world to it, the question is, who gets to define the city? And
what's LA without food carts? That's vendors.
That's right. Recently, Joe Biden came to Los Angeles. Mayor Karen Bass decided to take Joe Biden out to CJ's Cafe in Mid-City, which is a historically African-American neighborhood, but which has also seen a lot of Mexican-American culture permeate there over the past few decades. And it's like, there's an embrace of historic LA. Now, when we talk about graffiti and graffiti culture, and as you were saying, what makes a neighborhood hip? To what extent can we recognize the way that graffiti and the way that these artists make this city and make this city go round at that? So I think you're onto something there when you say that, hey, if there's all this money coming in to Los Angeles for what Los Angeles is, for Los Angeles as a place for the world, as a place for the globe, why not recognize graffiti culture's part in that, hip hop culture's part in that altogether? I think that's something Nipsey Hussle would be all for in actuality.
R.I.P.
R.I.P. Nip.
Yeah, absolutely. It is interesting to see how they're gonna reconstruct everything and how the funds are gonna come in for what's considered a cleanup. What's considered damage to a wall when you're applying paint to it? Is that really damaging a wall at this point? I mean, you see how many walls are buffed constantly, and it's like, does this look better than what was there before? You have to kind of question yourself. But I mean, I'm also at a point where I understand both sides to that element. You know, as far as property, who wants their property damaged or like constantly just gone over or something along those lines. But
right, and I do feel like there's an important note there, because for me, there's a difference between tagging and graffiti art. One is about getting up and making a name for themselves and kind of letting everybody know that they're here and that they are unafraid, unapologetic in who they are and what they represent. And then the other is also about that, but in a far more inclusive way, in a far more inviting way, because it's about art. And I notice through and through that when we provide the latter, and that when these communities have involved the rest of the community in the art making, in uplifting what the art is and who it's for and how it belongs to everybody, I notice that that tends to get respect and keep respect. And so I wonder again a little bit about the communication and the way that we cannot simply lump all these things up together and call all graffiti one thing, call all tagging one thing. They have their distinct areas, their distinct realms, but it's important for us to see those distinctions, because we can use that as a tool basically to identify where graffiti lives and who it's speaking to, and where this is about something else. This is about just getting up, and there's something deeper there, and we can tap into it further in a different respect. But especially as a city that is seeking to criminalize people less for who they are
and especially when they cannot defend themselves in court through hiring a private attorney and so on, then guess what? Graffiti needs to be involved in that too, because this is not just about criminality or about blight or about the broken window theory, as you were saying earlier.
No, for sure. Yeah, no, shout out you, Jimbo. I appreciate you having me, first and foremost, and participating on something like this, and your interest in, you know, the pro promotion of street art, and the whole street art graffiti culture and scene. It's grown to you know, it's grown past hip hop at this point. It's become its own culture in a way where there's no race, gender boundary. You know, these days it's like you said, we were talking a little about that. And just it's crazy how, you know, how much things have changed, and you can kind of see that in the art. It's no longer like people aren't from neighborhoods or, you know, inner city all the time. Some people are making the pilgrimage to LA from outside of the city, just to be a part of this action of, you know, and it's inherently anarchy. There's a lot of it's a young people full contact kind of thing. Where a lot of during its developing and pioneering, there were no art programs. So it's a lot of, you know, how the culture was developed and things like that. It has a history, just kind of like hip hop culture itself or punk rock culture. There's a double edged sword to, like, you know, the music and the culture. But then there's another thing about being a part of the scene. It's a real, and we were talking a little about this earlier, it's a thin line between, honestly, like street culture and what you would call, like, you know, gangsterisms and graffiti, they walk a real thin line out here in LA, and it's very much still alive with that. And I feel like that's what makes LA different specifically with any other city when it comes to that. But me being on something like Jimbo's program, yeah, it's like I want to be able to promote responsibly.
Right. I feel that, man. I feel that. I mean, it really is about connecting with the neighborhood and seeing it for more than just a place to privatize, and seeing it for more than just as another place to police. Absolutely. Out of existence. Because going back to Virgil Avenue and the way that these historic Central American communities especially have lost so much ground over the last few years, it was through policing and it was through these policies against the working poor. It was through evictions. It was through incarceration and so much other forms of dehumanizing the very people who make up the city. And for me, it's a fascinating question, as we have council members like Hugo Soto Martinez or Eunices Hernandez or Nithya Raman or Mayor Karen Bass, who is from historic South LA. It's interesting to think a little bit about their interpretation of the city and its resources and its possibilities, given that they have this proximity to those neighborhoods in ways that their predecessors have not had. And so they should have more sympathy. They should have more cultural understanding, and therefore they should be enacting more culturally conscious policymaking when it comes to graffiti and when it comes to access through the neighborhood, what art is and who it belongs to. And why not? Now, the other part that I really wanted to get into about for a second with you is actually a little bit of, again, the public versus the private interest. So, like, when we have a wall somewhere, let's go back to Virgil Avenue for a minute. When we have a wall on Virgil Avenue and, let's say, Santa Monica Boulevard, and it's blank and it belongs to a store somewhere, one day a young person makes their way through, decides to mark it up, and then you have another group of kids who come out one day and they also decide to mark it up. The same story has played out in Los Angeles time and time again. For me, those writers exist for a reason, and they are getting their name out there in a certain way for some kind of purpose, either to vent, either to express their frustration, either to rebel, and so on and so forth. And for me, the question is, how do you reach them in ways that are not punitive, in ways that are actually full of compassion for what they are, and full of more possibilities. How do you approach that kind of tension on the street, thinking about possibilities and even constructive possibilities, rather than just how you punish them and how you do away with what it is that they are trying to express? That's an important question for me, because that's going to continue to play out once again as more of these for lease signs go up, as more of these businesses are abandoned, and as somebody somewhere says, hey, this is my property, while somebody else says, actually, this is on the street and it belongs to everybody.
I always tell people when I'm like I used to volunteer with young kids in certain programs, and it's when you help them learn or teach them things like graffiti or street art, you don't ever do this on walls until you get really, really good.
Right.
You know, like, get paid to do it. Don't go out here just, you know, I'm teaching you how to do this. But there's a lot to it, though. It's educating kids, like, where does it come from? And I remember we did this, and one time I was visiting in New York City in East Harlem, and I remember that one lesson that stuck to me is we're teaching these inner city kids, and it was what's behind the name? What is in a name? And every kid had their own, you know? And every kid, they would, you know, mention like what their name was and why they wanted that, or why they called them that. And it was really interesting on, you know, hearing their perspective. They were painting a community wall. And I think on the wall, there was some font that said something like unity. And they would ask each individual kid, you know, what would you draw, or why don't you draw something that you think of when you think of unity? And each one would have something that they had thought of, and we actually helped them paint that on a wall. And to mention, like, again, it's a double-edged sword. Yeah, there's a lot of people out here tagging, but it's not just that. Shout out Grubzy. If you've heard of Grubzy,
she's
from East Los. You can find her on Instagram. Okay. I'll show you her Instagram. Yeah. I plan on doing some sort of like maybe a workshop or something with her, like a pop-up. She does a lot of, she's a young mom hailing from East Los, and she's literally recently gotten a lot of like Instagram traction and things like that.
Okay.
But it's good for her, because I feel like, you know, it's a perspective, and like you said, in a community, she's young and she's not really taking the whole tagger path or that lane. She's kind of made her own lane and being a young mom. And if you check out our art, you'll know what I mean. It's really like, it's for the kids in a way.
Right.
So it'd be cool to get involved with something with her over on her side of town. Vice versa, bring the homies from East Los over to Koreatown, and we exchange the styles. Like, you know, I really appreciate like letters and fonts, and, you know, just a real nerd on like typography and things like that. But I think that's important. Going back to what you were talking about, like teaching kids like the history and art behind that. You don't have to, and it's a different age now. It's not the same. The same era that we grew up in with graffiti. I feel like it's grown to be, you know, kids nowadays, it's not like, hey, what do you write? It's more like, hey, what do you write? Like, you know, oh, cool, like, I write this. And kids are exchanging more, and there is a lot more cultural exchange these days.
Right. It's interesting to me as well, because going back to the graffiti tower for a moment, I think about the TikTokers, and LA is full of TikTokers and full of YouTubers at every local spot that is most recently trending, right? And I think a little bit about how, like, when people are out there on the street, they are out in public, and based on most laws, when you're out in public, and it's not just in Los Angeles, but it's across the United States, you have the right to record out there. And that is true whether the people or the places you're recording consent to it or not. Now, when you enter some of these spaces, the rules and the situation changes. But generally speaking, when you're out there, a TikToker, exactly the way the TikTokers were doing outside of Graffiti Tower, that's a right that they have based on the U.S. Constitution and so on and so forth. Now, it's interesting because in today's day and age, these videos and the stories told through these videos and the stories that blow up and go viral and sometimes inform or misinform, educate or miseducate people out there, those have serious reverberations, serious impacts. And yet, we haven't quite regulated that space as much as we've regulated that young person who goes up and writes their name on the wall. Even though that's far less likely to be viral, even though that's far less likely to be distorted to tell some untruth, even though it's mostly just an inside joke or it's kind of an inside or an insider's affair. And so I'm thinking a little bit about the similarities and also the differences between how we don't regulate technology as much as we can and how on the other hand, we overregulate things such as graffiti towers, spending millions upon millions, ultimately ineffectively regulating them, because just like immigration and just like the border, we don't stop people from crossing over. They have a need to cross over. Similarly, for Graffiti Tower, you've got a lot of young people and a lot of ambitious writers out there in this city that is made on blowing yourself up and going viral and getting seen. You are not going to stop them from doing that. So then if one approach fails, we have to try another, in my view. But these are kind of interesting parallels.
Yeah, shout out TikTok. Right. Shout out TikTok. Yeah, and there's a lot of TikTokers. Graffiti towers, or we keep calling it graffiti towers, but that's what it is. It's the Oceanside Plaza. When you go out there right now, there's somebody shooting some sort of video or taking photos there right now. It's
just
crazy.
Lit. It's just lit.
It's a dope phenomenon, I think, like seeing people.
So LA.
And LA obviously loves the art. LA obviously loves street art. They obviously love graffiti. I mean, it's a big hub for it. I mean, you've seen the Shohei Ohtani mural reveal for Dodgers opening day. That was right. Amazing. That's like one of the biggest murals on the skyline here in LA, painted by a graffiti artist.
Now, for you personally, actually, I want to ask you a little bit about murals now that you mentioned that. I want to ask you if you've looked into mural work and as you were saying earlier, workshops and things of that sort more recently, because again, going back to how we impact a neighborhood, I think a little bit about the way murals have such a deep influence on the way communities see themselves reflected out there. And so I can't help but ask you if you've thought about this or looked into this, or if you're currently exploring this as a possibility for yourself as a writer.
Yeah, I mean, I think 2 years ago, we actually did some work with People's Cafe 1312.
Okay.
It was in El Monte, and we painted a wall out there. They wanted some artists to come out and paint a wall. And we were kind of like, you know, what do you want? They're like, whatever you want. And we did our names, but we did do some extra fonts or anything they wanted as far as a message. And it was they did stress that they wanted it for the people. And like, you know, like me, I'm 33 now, and just seeing how it's evolved, I definitely want to grow out of you know, just being active in graffiti. You can't do graffiti forever. I see myself growing out into doing more legal works. And I have mentors in my crew. Shout out iOS. It's on site. It's our season. A lot of homies in my crew are actually big influences on me. And they've been teaching me how to hone in and just kind of like do more murals and do like pieces of art that last you longer. Because paint's not cheap these days. And paint's expensive.
Well, then that's the other part of it is Los Angeles is the entertainment capital of the world. And so you've got a lot of people out there, even a lot of entities out there, making quite a bit of money off of these historic neighborhoods that they may not actually have more than a connection to outside of the lease with their name on it. And so, and so it's interesting that folks can show up to Los Angeles tomorrow, sometimes with billions of dollars, and convert that or make more from there on, while so many of the artists who have played kind of a pivotal role in creating this culture that now everybody wants a little bit of, everybody, including the TikTokers, want a little part of. It's interesting to think that, hey, actually, there aren't as many pathways for them to go ahead and make a living for themselves off of the art that they have produced. And so we need to get in there, right? I mean, nowadays, some graffiti writers or certain graffiti writers have world renown. you can think of like a Banksy, for example, and you can think about Banksy's art going for millions of dollars on end in galleries all across out there. And so I think a little bit about how you take that model, but actually spread it across the board so that you have more opportunities for these legacy artists, but also these up and coming artists to just produce a living for themselves in this increasingly expensive city that is Los Angeles, because so many other entities are, and therefore these members of our community should have access just as well, in my view.
Yeah, no, for sure. Full circle on like places like Robinson Space, like for artists, things like this. This is like key, I believe. And seeing viral things and like the whole glamour of TikTok, it's crazy seeing like the development of people in their profiles and just seeing people on the streets like TikToking and stuff. But sometimes likes doesn't really equal like, you know, like value, you know, like, yeah, good job. Like you have a pretty face, or that was a really good shot. But it's like there's so many artists here in LA, you're right, where I've met them, and the amount of talent or, you know, just their ideas are slept on. And it's right. Like they're just in this giant ocean, you know, what is it? It's small fish, big ocean,
right,
along those lines. Right. But Just seeing people underappreciated, and that's another thing with technology and how it's like it just changed like this whole generation. It's like we're kind of like desensitized to a lot of like, you know, a lot of things, and it's like where is it gonna go in the future, basically, like as far as the future of art and the future of graffiti and things like that? Because lately it's just because you get a lot of likes does not mean your art is dope, respectfully, you know.
Big facts.
I might step on some toes by saying that, but
factory. Yeah, that's right. I mean, the central concern is that at the end of the day, this has been the case recurringly. So you and I were talking a little bit about hip hop culture at the outset, and I mentioned an artist like Mos Def or an artist like Nasir Jones. For me, those are titans, and they were never necessarily mainstream. Mobb Deep is another one of them who never really made a whole lot of noise on the charts, who didn't see the whole world, but who actually small underground communities all the way out in Berlin or Slovakia or wherever, who they're fully, fully tapped in with, because these artists and what they spoke about and the way that they expressed themselves made impressions that, though they might not have 100,000 likes on some TikTok video out there today, guess what? They more than speak to 100,000 people all over the world out there.
It's a message. So,
definitely, definitely.
Yeah, so, you're such a hip hop head. Yeah, Mos Def is fire.
Oh my goodness, man. RIP Prodigy.
Right, that's right. Yeah. That's right. Mobb Deep. Yeah, Mos Def has gotten better since, you know, over the years. He's got people like him and like Black Thought, they've gotten better. You know, there's message in that. And you're right, they were mad slept on for many years. And it's crazy how that develops with somebody like Dave Chappelle. He was always featured on Dave Chappelle's show as like a guest. Yeah, they were always making stuff together.
Yeah,
and look at them now. Like it's dope to see people's growth, even on like humble beginnings within the industry and things like that. But just to put like backtrack and put some perspective, these kids climbing the graffiti towers and risking their lives and like hopping fences, these guys aren't doing it for a paycheck. And that's the most hip-hop thing you can really be on, you know, where there is no boundary of race, color, creed, economic background, but there is an inherent, like, it's a game that graffiti writers play, and it's a beautiful thing. It's something that you can't really commodify, even though they have, like, you know, create an industry, and there's now, like, graffiti shops and things like that, but it's definitely something that it's still underground, and it's still being, like, it's still like for the kids are still doing it, and it's alive and well, basically. And, you know, I think it has a bright future, and who knows what's next with that.
I actually get a lot out of that because art preceded capitalism, and art actually did precede the written language out there. And we go back to caves all the way in deep Spain somewhere to trace the story of the way that human civilizations came into formation. And it gives me a lot of hope to hear somebody say that actually the artists and those who are ambitious about their artwork, they're not looking to get paid. They're doing this because it fulfills something far deeper than what a single dollar bill or a $100 bill can make up for them, right?
So next time you're driving on the freeway, don't text and drive. It's bad for your health.
Facts.
Stay off your phone, but enjoy the traffic, embrace the traffic, and check out some graffiti and, you know, read the words. And, you know, honestly, you should just take some time and appreciate like what's around you. And I think there is a surplus on like just being the society, you know, where we live in, where we're all in our phones all the time. And I feel like there's probably going to be a shift in that, like eventually. Like, how long has Instagram been big on, you know, in our culture? It's been like 10 years. I think it's probably like one of the longest living social media kind of
juggernauts. Definitely. And it has to have its time. And I mean, that's why tapping in and speaking with people IRL or in real life and getting into work that involves your hands and that involves seeing the rest of the world out there, as is the case with so much of this street art, that actually fulfills a part of you that just isolating yourself and seeing it through the screen cannot achieve for you. So it ultimately becomes advocating for the human experience and human connection in so many different respects. And I gotta shout you out and really thank you for your time and for speaking to these issues with so much respect and candor.
No, I appreciate you. And it was definitely like, you definitely have that perspective. You already know what's going on. And I love your social commentary and just how involved you are with the community. It's really dope. It's wholesome. It's definitely dope.
100%. And I'm excited to just tap into all of it further with you, Horrible Vandal, and to all of the writers.
Horrible.
And to all of the writers and artists out there, wherever they may be coming from, I'm certainly rooting for us through this city, rooting for our safety, rooting for our success, rooting for our dividends out here.
I wanted to ask you about something like a podcast idea. I want to interview people while on a bike. I wonder if I could windproof a mic somehow and just interview different graffiti writers specifically that are messengers here in LA. Because I work with a lot of them.
That is so cool.
I think that would be something.
I think that would be special, man. I would love to put that together. I mean, if I don't know that any other city has done that yet, so we might be putting LA on the map.
If you have any ideas for any, you know, text work, font work, graffiti stuff, you know, walls painted.
Definitely. Oh, for sure. We're going to get into that. And so once again, I got to shout you out for Los Cuentos de Los Angeles. Let us know whenever you're able to pop into the studio with us again so that we can catch up and talk some more about the spaces and the places and the people who make up our city out here, because you already know they're priceless.
Of course. Yo, shout out JT, the storyteller.
Hey.
Robinson Space.
Hey.
This was a lot of fun. I really appreciate it.
Oh, and we're doing it again soon. You're going to see. By the way, I got these threads for you.
I saw that.
You already know. Let's go.
Yeah.
Put it on the map.
It's Jimbo times.